Welcome back to 10 Questions with this week's guest, one of my favourite people in Australian show business, Matt Preston. Matt's one of the most recognisable faces in Australia due to his role as a judge on MasterChef, but his story started in England, going to boarding school, then the University of Kent, before following his father into journalism. Matt wrote about television in Britain before the company he worked for sent him out to Australia to write about TV here. He then segued into writing about food for The Age, News Corp, and the magazine Inside Melbourne. In this interview, Matt will tell us about the random way in which he won the MasterChef gig, a juggernaut of a show which played in 110 countries to an audience of 180 million people. Matt starred on MasterChef for 11 seasons, and now he's written his 8th book, Matt Preston's World of Flavour, where, among other things, he's uncovered the genesis of spaghetti bolognese. Spoiler, it's not a New Zealand invention, it's an Australian invention, or more accurately, a South Australian invention. But as usual, I started proceedings by asking Matt when he was most happy.
Oh, you know, what do you want? The cliched stuff is obviously child 1, 2, 3 wedding. You know, that's the...
Yeah, yeah.
You've got to, and look, that genuinely is, that those are the moments. Other moments that I think it's when happiness, but there's happiness, which is kind of a warm, fuzzy glow. Then there's elation. Then there's a moment when you explode. And that would invariably be football based. Whether that's the Victorian code or the world game. You know, it's things like when that goal was scored in the FA Cup final. It was being in Stockholm Stadium when Gianfranco Zola comes on and scores as his first touch as a substitute in the Cup Winners' Cup final. It's it's all those brilliant. It's being with a load of Carlton supporters, and it's a really tight game, and they think that they won, and we wind them in and beat them, and that immense pleasure that comes of, you know, in the old days, you'd be standing with a rum and coke, fourth quarter, down on the boundary fence, surrounded by your cart mates, you know, giving it large, you know, a certain amount of that going on. Yeah, because those are, and then the other area, obviously, is music. I mean, it's one of the things, music is, as John Miles said, music is my first love and it will be my last. And some of those things, you know, it's the difference between music, that's why music is so much superior to food, is you'll be in a crowd of maybe 100 people sing at an early U2 performance or 50,000, 60,000 people at Glastonbury when Jarvis Crocker breaks into singing Common People or the Gallagher boys crack into playing Wonderwall, and the whole audience is singing along with you. Or it'll be outside. I was consoling a mate who'd just been dumped by his girlfriend, and I had a bloke who worked in a travel agency. He found me a really cheap price to go to Malta. So I flew him to Malta. So we went to Malta, and Malta's an odd place to go. We end up one night in St. Paul in the nightclub district, and he was feeling very down in the mouth. And we're just sitting there, and at the same moment, about four groups of people walked past us going in different directions, and out from a bar came the first bars of REM's, first notes of REM's Losing My Religion. And everybody spontaneously, us, the Maltese kids, the tourists, everyone started seeing that first stanza of Losing Our Rhythm. And it's like, and there's that moment of connection that's another one of those moments.
And that cheered him up?
No, he was still really depressed. he went back, he was fine. He reunited, they got married. I was at the wedding, it was all great.
I need to ask you some follow-up. So we're obviously talking about Collingwood.
Yes.
And what's your football? What's your
the mighty Chelsea Football Club? I grew up within 3 minutes walk of the ground for the first 6 years of my life, and then 10 minutes walk of the ground. So absolutely central to who I was as a kid. It was, you know, it was the old territorial days of football that, you know, you live near the ground, you went every Saturday, you went in the boys' entrance at the shed end, you avoided the really scary big guys because you never knew what they were carrying in their jacket.
That's right. Because I wasn't really aware of this kind of the boys section and everything until I read Fever Pitch, Nick Hornby's book on Arsenal.
It's Fever Pitch also when he was at college and supporting like Reading or a third tier league where they always throw a frog into the middle of the road before they went to the game. a little chewy, like a gummy frog, like a gummy bear.
Did he go to Oxford or Cambridge? I'm not sure, but it was
it was Oxford United, I think
Oxford United. Right. Yes, Oxford United.
And look, I mean, that's the whole thing about supporting a club and the happiness that brings is there's happiness just not getting pumped by 10 goals. There's happiness always going there. There's happiness with that one win of the season when you've lost every other game. So I mean, I think that it's not happiness. It burns brightly, but it but gee, it's good when it happens.
Yeah, I mean, 2010, you must have been very happy. The second week.
Well, no, so I wasn't very happy because what I'd done is I'd arranged that I'd go the first week, and then the week after I'd committed to going to the Flinders Rangers with a famous chef called Renio Rizzetti, who's an old mate. And so the second week I'm going, I've got to go. So I watched the game. I watched the game in an Aboriginal community in Flinders Rangers, eating grilled kangaroo tail, drinking West End bitter, and watching it on an old rear projection television. But it was still sweet.
Oh, wow.
It was still sweet. But then, you know, it's not the same as being there. It's not that moment where when you really, it's happening. It's not that moment you look around and you see 70-year-old men crying because it's been so long. I mean, it's a beautiful thing. And I think we all, you know, anyone with a soul felt for the Bulldogs, felt for Melbourne, and feels right now, you know, those poor old St Kilda.
I know that anyone with a soul doesn't feel for Carlton, which is a shame.
Ever. Because you know what it is? And look, I think Richmond fans are a little bit guilty of this after their 3 out of 4. There's a smugness that comes with victory.
Mm.
And it's not the first one, but it's when you had a little period, you become a bit smug and maybe a little bit patronising. Mm. It'll be your day Wednesday soon. Yes. And look, I think all football fans are vulnerable to that, but there's something about Carlton, about Carlton fans. There's a sense that they deserve to be there, that it's their rightful place. And I don't think that's a sense that maybe that I'm going to say that the certainly St Kilda fans are all about, you know, our pace is to suffer.
Mm.
Collingwood fans, I think we've had so many years of, and Melbourne fans, we had so many years of nothing. We're just used to it. It's what we expect.
Mm.
You know, Collingwood will always let you down. I mean, it's the self-destructive nature of football club.
It's interesting that you kind of got a sense of that having arrived in Australia in the 90s, which is essentially, I mean, we won a premiership in 95, but it's all been downhill since then. So you've seen really the struggle of Carlton as opposed to
the first two games I went to see were a football word in the UK were at the game between Carlton and Hawthorn, and then the game the year later, the famous Battle of Britain. Between North Melbourne and Carlton. So I was familiar with Carlton and I had Carlton fans, Aussie mates with Carlton fans, and they were going to see them was like going to go and see the Boy King.
Yeah.
I mean, come see Carlton, the greatest football team in the world. And so I arrived here I arrived here having made my decision to be a Collingwood supporter, fortuitously the same team that my wife's family support. Mm. But I'd made that decision. I was dating an Australian in London, and she used to leave me on Saturday to go and make her TV, children's TV show, and she'd turn on the Stephen Quatermain highlight show. And this is after our first date had been at the Battle of Britain. And I just fell in love with number 35, the magnificent Peter Dacos. Yeah. And so any guy can do this. I didn't know anything about the team, had no idea what sort of team they were or what they stood for or what they meant. And I was just mesmerized by number 35 and by the kind of way that Darren Mullane used to stand up for his mates was also really powerful. Number 42. So I think I arrived. What do we think? I arrived October. So after grand final, I arrived October, Derby Day, 93. 94, we played West Coast and got thumped. And then I don't think we made finals for years and years and years.
Not until Malthouse.
Here was this terrible thing that I'd come around the world. I had that free pass to pick the football team. I could pick any football team I wanted. I could have picked a Geelong. I could have picked anyone I wanted. Yeah. I could have picked a winning team. And I lumbered myself with the same Chelsea at that point. It had you know, not since the 70s that they'd won anything. So I'd come the other side of the world and I love myself with another team that did nothing. But luckily both have come good in the ensuing years.
What about your countryman Christian O'Connell's luck of going for Melbourne?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, look, I'm surprised he's a Melbourne supporter. I am. I would have had him down. I would have had him down as an Essendon supporter. He looks like an Essendon supporter to me. I don't know what you think. You know what I mean? He kind of has that Essendon look about him. Yeah, well, exactly. There's an example. But again, you can't say anything. I won't say anything wrong about Melbourne. I have lots of Melbourne supporter friends. They feel their pain. I feel their pain. And they've been beautiful. They've not become smug after winning. They've just been joyously excited because they were convinced it wasn't going to happen. They were convinced it was going to be another annal in the horrors that they've had to live through.
Whereas me and George, we continue to suffer.
You seem to pick up lots of good players, and you know.
Oh yeah, I mean,
We'll do all right.
We'll see. I do know the person who. Adam Briggs, who's the comedian and screenwriter, he said that his auntie was the person who put the who laid the Carlton curse in the 90s. Really? Yeah, yeah.
So from Shepparton.
Yeah.
Laid it from Shepparton all the way. Nice. Great. I'm a tracker down next time up in the north.
Yeah.
Northeast and buy a slab of sponge.
Yeah, that's so right. Question.
Very nice.
Question two. Who would you like to apologize to and why?
Well, undoubtedly to my wife. Always the woman I love. That long suffering nature. Oh, really? Did you eat the last of the cheese? Yes. You did do that. I did. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. And because in that way that, you know, she's a far better person than I am, but invariably there's probably something that I've inadvertently done, you know? Oh yeah, no, I did do that. Yeah, I did scratch the car. Oh yeah, that was me. So that's normal. And I think the apology probably isn't for those things. The apology is I will try and be more focused and better, you know, because it is in a relationship, it is our role, isn't it, to be better within the relationship when we were the year before.
Yeah, but you own up, it sounds like, which is great.
Oh, you got to own up. Oh, yeah, you got to own up. There's no. I learned very early on when I started dating Emma. I had been seeing someone else, but Emma and I were together. It was great. Emma's mother went out with her best friend, and Emma's mother said, "Oh, Emma's a better girl." And Emma's mother's best friend went, "Oh, that's really funny because one of my daughter's best friends, she met a guy as well. So they both met guys. That's good." And Emma's mother said, "Oh, this guy's English." "No, there must be a boatload. Come on, because other." And so it transpired. They went down and they went, "This guy's called Matt. This guy's called Matt." And Emma's mother's on the phone going, "Matt's dating someone else." And Emma's gone, he was seeing someone about a month ago, but that's all over. And so that was that moment when you go, you don't lie and you don't try and hide stuff in Australia because it'll be found out. Everyone knows everything. It's too small.
That's right.
Everyone talks too much.
Yeah.
It's too dangerous.
Yeah, that's exactly right, mate.
Act and behave better than you should do. I mean, that's the other thing. When you start getting on TV and you would have found that, you know, you can't roll outside the cafe and park in the handicap zone or in the, you know. You just don't do those things because you know we shouldn't do them anyway, but you know you're going to get sprung and you'll look like an idiot. So I think it should make you a better person most, and that seems to be the case 90% of the time.
Yeah, yeah, it's a hard lesson.
Yeah.
Yeah. Question three, what is your greatest regret?
I've got three. One, not buying a 1964 bright print Ford Galaxy convertible for my friend Matthew for £500. I should have bought it. I should have scraped the money together because just to have owned that car and driven it around, albeit for a week until it broke down, would have been amazing. I walked past a in London, but I think of this must have been around 94. I'd just come back from Australia and I'd been to see an exhibition by an artist called Robert Campbell Jr. at the MCA. Amazing, you know, Indigenous artist. And I walked past this this hairdresser, and there was a huge like 60-40 painting of Madonna and Child done by Robert Campbell Jr. for sale in the window for, I think it was £1,000. And I looked at it and went, oh, that is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. I didn't go back and sell my record collection because I would have loved that. I wish I'd bought that. And the third one, wow. I mean, this goes back to soccer. You know, I'd gone back to England for the cup final, which was great. We'd won. Chelsea were also in the Champions League final. Our Champions League final, for people who don't understand than soccer, that's like the pinnacle. That's like the ultimate thing to win. You don't. That would be like if there was a premiership of all the premierships, you know, you might win it. You know, it's every team in Europe. It's all the, but the, every great team is playing it. We made through. It was in Bayern Munich against Bayern. Someone offered me a ticket. Someone else offered me a seat on the bus to drive over there. And I was having, and I was committed to going and being like doing a cooking demo at the Noosa Food and Wine Festival. And I went back to the Noosa Food and Wine Festival and it was the right thing to do, but I reckon I could have worn the hatred for 3 days of being there for Drogba's amazing performance and to be there when we won. Cause that the chance of that happening again in my lifetime, you know, it's less scam.
Well, it is. It's interesting when you get older, you realize that those chances are slipping away. Right. You know, that, you know, I wonder when Carlton will ever play finals or, you know, it's just one of those things.
But at least, you know, with Chelsea, cause there's so much money in the sport, you know, you know that the rich clubs will always have a chance. You know, my mother and my sister both support Fulham and they're damned to be yo-yoing, you know, up and down between the Premiership and the Championship, you know, one season up, one season down, one season up. So that's there's never a hope for that. So I think it's beholden on me if Chelsea do make a final to be there.
Yeah, cancel any festivals. What question four is, what will you still need to do to feel you've lived a satisfactory life?
Wow. I think, again, it goes back to kids and it goes back to healthy, happy kids happily progressing on their own career trajectory. I mean, that's probably the best thing. I think that, and I think that's the real legacy. On the shallow side, if more people learn how to make a spanakopita in a toasty machine, then my job on this planet is done. If people start putting phyllo pastry in their toasty makers to make apple pies and you know, that lovely kind of ricotta and wilted green filling of a spanakopita, and suddenly toasties were being made using frozen phyllo as opposed to using bread, I feel I would have progressed people's happiness along just a little bit.
That's great. Who is the person who most influenced you and how?
Lots of people. I mean, I spend my whole time asking questions and listening to people, you know, whether it's talking to my grandmother about what they like to cook or what they did or talking to, you know, anyone in their kids come up and say what they cook and you want to talk to them about that. I think in terms of big influences, a wonderful guy, a chef called Robert Castellani had said this great thing that he was a chef at a restaurant called Donovan's. And he said, it's never about the, not about the food on the table. It's about the eyes across the table. And that, you know,
that's lovely.
That's absolutely central. The idea is the people you're with and to celebrate the people you're with. Enjoy the food, but it's really about the people you're with. I once got to, at school, we had a guest speaker. He was a guy, an author who was quite famous at the time called Frederick Forsyth. He wrote a book called Day of the Jackal, another one called The Odessa File. And we had a very, very boring head of school who was on one side of him. So I got to talk to him for 2 hours. He was amazing.
Oh, wow.
Really, it was really, really cool. And he was a lovely, fascinating, open guy. And at the end of the meal, he just leaned across to me and said, look, I just want to tell you one thing. Never discount where the next great idea is going to come from. Talk to everybody, listen to everybody. Because in my life, I found that the best plot twists have come from, you know, they've not been talking to another author. They might be talking to they might be having a chat with the guy at the post office or the guy that delivered the milk. And so, you know, to be open and to, you know, the old idea.
Yeah.
Two ears, one mouth.
To
listen and to ask questions look, you know, all my cookbooks, they would not exist without the people I've talked to. You know, that's where the ideas come from. If I come up with invariably it's talking with people about food and them sharing ideas. You know, one of the recipes I'm best known for, which is a mayonnaise, which you make with an immersion blender, a stick blender, and you put everything into a cup together and you go voop and you pull it together. You make instant mayonnaise. It's a brilliant idea. That was sent to me by a guy called Matt Follas, a New Zealander who'd won MasterChef a long time ago. And he'd seen something I'd written. And he said, oh, look, saw you like that. You should have a look at this. And he sent me the recipe. And I went, how lovely is that? So that ability of being open and and literally stuff coming to you, being drawn into you is, you know, that's the way. That's far better than that kind of one man is an island and, you know, I'm going to sit, no influences, sit in my hermit-like cell trying to come up with ideas. I'm a huge believer in cross-pollination and collegiate working processes.
And were you always like that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, no, I'm sure there were terrible times when I was convinced, you know, when you're young, you're convinced you're right about everything, aren't you? I mean, that's, you know, and maybe... Mm. And you're right, maybe 30% of the time, which just convinces you to keep on doing that. So, you know, in terms of doing things like running clubs or promoting bands in the UK, that was possibly the case. But no, by and large, I think I've always felt that working with people, you get much, much better stuff. You just got to find the right people to work with, and sometimes that's hard. I mean, you're lucky in terms of your writing partner, but you just want to find the right fellow travelers, because gee, it's good.
So I mean, important,
mate. I've got a team of maybe four people, and they all worked on the book with me. They all worked on me with on the book with me. They worked on the shoot with me, and that was just like heaven because they know you so well. You know, they go, have you thought about doing it this way? What about doing that? And that's how recipes get better. Or someone just sends you in a totally different direction saying, you know, you could do this with this. And you go, oh, that's amazing. And off
that's
you go.
That's great.
You know, that stuff is, but food especially, it's really interesting. Historically, food was terribly much about the head chef, and he had his ideas, told everyone what to do. You know, if you went to go and learn from someone like Gordon Ramsay, you had to spend 2 years at Gordon Ramsay so you could do, he would give you 6 months in each section. So you couldn't learn all his tricks in a month and then go on and do something else. There's another famous chef in Adelaide who, when he went away, used to bury all his recipes in a biscuit tin at the end of the garden and no one else could get them. So there's a whole range of that.
That's amazing.
And I think that's been the wonderful thing. And that sort of started with a guy called Ferran Adrià, Spanish chef at El Bui, that he would, at the end of the year, or the beginning of January, he'd do a presentation. He'd go, here are the 25 new techniques we've come up with in my laboratory for last season's menu. I'm showing you how to do all of them. Now you take them and go and do other stuff for them. So they had their year. They had their year of having this with you. Then they went away and said, look, here, you try making an ice cream without sugar. See what happens. Try this technique when you vacuum pack a peach with whiskey in it, and the vacuum packing opens up the pores of the peach and the whiskey sucks into the peach, so you get a whiskey soaked peach. I mean, the thing, just little nerd ideas like that, you just would openly just go, here everybody, have a look. And that, so I think that's been a massive change in food. It's also, you know, it's, there's nothing better than going and then trying something and going, oh yeah, okay, you're right, that's so much better, you know. So I love a self-sourcing chocolate pudding. My mate Warren said, have you tried it with flake salt? We went away together, we made it with flake salt, we had chocolate pudding with flake salt. Bam! That is so amazing, so delicious.
Isn't that interesting?
So, you know, and that's, you know, you're so much stronger. You're so much stronger with five heads rather than one.
I've been thinking about you recently because I've been reading the Anthony Bourdain book written by his assistant.
Oh, yeah.
Matt appeared in the Anthony Bourdain series No Reservations in 2009, just before he started on MasterChef. The episode's on YouTube, and you can see the kinship between these two very tall writer/cooks as Matt shows Anthony the culinary delights of Sydney Road, Brunswick, and introduces him to the Melbourne inventor game, Trugo.
I met him twice. I met him on the first time he was here, and the second time spent more time with him. Yeah, it would have been. It was before MasterChef happened. Actually, it was before MasterChef happened. So he was on the lunches and dinners. He was giving me advice. He was saying, okay, you're going to be on television, and he said, look, here's one bit of advice. This should sit in the previous question. He said, one bit of advice I'm going to give you: never, ever, ever let anyone sit on your lap while you're doing an autograph. So if you want an autograph, sign an autograph. But never on a body part, never let them sit on the lap. He said, when he started on TV, he was in Boston, it was a signing for the first book, This lovely old lady, looked like your nan, came up, about 85, came up and said, can I get a photo, Tony? So he said, okay, yeah. So do you mind? I said, on your lap, Tony. And he went, oh, yeah, okay, I suppose so. Nan's come here somewhere. And as the camera went up to take the snap, she got her hands and put them on either side of Tony Bourdain's head, dragged him in and planted the biggest, tiniest French kiss you've ever seen on Tony Bourdain as the camera's going off. And he's like, and that's why you never let them sit in your lap.
At the time of speaking to Bourdain, Matt knew he was going to be on a TV show designed to uncover Australia's best amateur cooks, but he had no idea how successful the show would be. When I asked him how he got the gig, he said he was quietly going about his business as the creative director for the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival when the phone rang.
I mean, again, it's that, you know, this is that whole small world listen thing. I got a phone call from my mother. My mother used to be a primary school teacher, and she worked with an Australian teacher. They remained good friends. Now we're 30 years further down the track, and the Australian teacher's got a daughter-in-law in casting. And she says, ring Matt Preston, ring Jennifer's son, Matt Preston. Now he knows about chefs. Give him, you ring and get him to suggest some people for you. So this person rings up and starts, you know, doing that TV thing of as they always do to journalists, are going, hi, we'd like you to be our consultant and not pay you, and could you give us every and tell me all the best chefs you've had on the Food and Wine Festival and who the great performers are. And so we went through this kind of process for about 40 minutes, and then they said, oh, just have you got a picture of you? So I sent them a picture of me looking disapprovingly at a salad. and the story goes, they were looking for two chefs and one host. That's what they're looking for. It's modeled on pretty much the UK show. And the story goes that image went from the casting person's desk to the producer's desk up to David Mott, who was head of programming. And the line came back, if thus this guy can string a sentence together, we're writing him a new role. They just like the look. They like the scar. They like the disapproving thing.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. It was nothing to do with my contact book. It was nothing to do with the fact I won awards for my writing, my essay writing. It was that I'd won this ridiculous award for world's best food writer. They didn't care about that.
And that's the
whole thing about TV. It was just, he looks right, he'll be fine. And then on that basis, they put a third spot in. Ironically, the person who's doing the casting was a woman called Henrietta Stride, who's been my manager now for 11 years.
Oh, really?
Which is fantastic. So she was there from very, very early on. Another one of those Cinderella moments, like when I started writing about food. Someone knocks on the door and says, "Do you want to write about food?" And you go, "Do I get paid? Can I take my mates?" They say yes. You go yes, and it's like, "Do you want to be on TV?" And it's like, I mean, I've been offered a few other bits of TV before, but they're always about being horrible. They're always like, you're just going to come in and you're going to be an absolute ass to these people. And, you know, I think when we started MasterChef, all three of us, we all wanted to be Randy. We all know, you go, girl. We want to be Marcia. We wanted to be the positive one, because there was no place for the histrionics, the kind of spitting and the, you know, all that ridiculous stuff of throwing food across the kitchen and, you know, all the stuff that people do because producers tell them to do it. So it was kind of a weird, and suddenly we're standing there, we're told it's a tiny show. We're told that, you know, look, there's no money, there's no budget for anyone. It's a really small production, you know, look, we'd love you to have a crack. So we turn up at Perth, there's 200 crew, they're giant techno jibs, and we go, they're taking this a bit serious, aren't they? And then from there on, but having said that, we still changed. I remember just turning up and the makeup. There was a big canteen where all these 200 crew were eating their breakfast, and there were the makeup chairs, and there was the wardrobe rack set up. It was like, just change over there. So the poor old crew got to see my faded pair of, faded pair of holy Calvin Kleins for breakfast, which would have made them distinctly unhappy. And so it was kind of, okay, this is an interesting experience.
It relaxed everyone, mate.
Yeah, that's what you do, isn't it? Make a fool of yourself, everyone's happy.
Well, look, it's an interesting thing because it was, you know, in my life, you know, as an adult, I think it was Secret Life of Us, Big Brother, and MasterChef, which all really kind of capture the group consciousness in such, well, the nation's kind of consciousness, yeah, in a way. And you know, those first few years, it's how did you handle the attention?
Because, well,
it was coming at you thick and fast.
Do we need to go back and go, so Secret Life of Us, Big Brother, MasterChef. So I believe probably all of those were commissioned by David Mott, same guy at Channel 10, which is interesting. You need to have David. David would be a good interview for you. He's an off-field character, but you've just, I think you're absolutely right. They all did capture him. Look, you know, for us, it was like, we had no idea. We had no idea what's going on. So you're just kind of like, oh, this is just normal, is it? The people turn up, they watch, they seem quite happy, and it all goes burko. Yeah. And it's all kind of, I mean, it's only probably after season five when it all went a bit pear-shaped, and you could see, you could feel the show lose its way, and you could feel everything falling out the back door. You realize how special
right,
years one and two were. I mean, the idea, it still bamboozles me that the two things about bamboozled. One, how many people watch MasterChef? You know, those numbers were just insane. And I suppose with the fractured nature of TV now, there'll never be a clip. So that's an amazing thing to have done. But then the other one was, you know, the fact that you could then, I don't know, you'd be, I don't know, I was on a holiday in Sri Lanka, and I was at an elephant orphanage, and these Bulgarians come up to me. They don't speak English, so the only word they know is MasterChef. And you go, how bizarre is that? You know, I'm on the island. And that whole thing of the show being watched by 19 million people each episode around the world, that's truly strange. But bizarrely, the best thing about it has been sitting in a restaurant in Hyderabad, there doing a story for Delicious, and these two kids, they would have been 11 and 12, brother and sister, come up and they come and say, hi, uncle, can we just say hello? I said, yes. And then, what do you like to cook? And they just said, we like frying things. And then we just had a conversation about frying stuff. And it's like moments like that, or moments of being in Portugal, where you know, I went to Portugal and that was crazy. The show was huge there. And just people just being nice, you know, people coming up and just saying things. Look, I know you don't speak Portuguese, but if you ever need someone to translate over the phone, you know, here's my number. Or I'm a fisherman. I reckon the best fish around here is at this restaurant. You should go and try that out. That's the real privilege, is that ability. And again, then, you know, that collegiate thing of learning from them and saying, how do you make this dish? Like I can ask someone, you know, how they make, you know, there's a great dish called, which is basically rice and prawns. And you can sit there and you can ask whether it's a grandmother or whether it's a cook, they'll share the information with you. And that then becomes something that you cook at home and eventually makes into a book.
What great intel just across the board. But you need to, as you say, the theme of this is you need to be open to it.
Oh, and look, and again, you know, if you think of the stuff that when I do that, you know, I'm now in the process of putting down notes for a book, kind of a memoir-y type piece of rubbish that will come out in the next year or so. And I'm writing down those moments that mean stuff. And, you know, one of the things that I look back on in, you know, the last 15 years that were kind of crazy fun to do, some of them are obviously, you know, related to MasterChef. So, you know, setting a challenge from the podium at the United Nations, like sitting in that United Nations room beneath the seal on that podium, and saying, going, we're filming in the UN. This is just insane. Bang. But then it's also the stuff where you find yourself, you know, you find yourself suspended dressed as the world's largest cherub with white, giant white wings above the stage at the Sydney Entertainment Centre, about to be, so you see, right, 80 feet up, 90 feet up, about to be sent down on wires to present an award, and you go, this is crazy. Being on your show, doing Lowdown, being on Lowdown, and again, you talk about never knowing when opportunities there. I mean, I remember Amanda telling me the story that she was sitting behind me. I think my wife and I just brought one of our kids back from hospital. We're having that coffee, the first coffee out of hospital, and she heard my voice, and she thought, I'll just write a. That voice sounds about the right, and I'll put in the show.
Well, we already had. It was even better than that, because what happened was we were looking for an inspector, a police inspector for this episode, and we're very influenced by Stephen Fry's character in Gosford Park, and we thought, who could play that in Australia? And we and we decided Matt Preston was the person. So we said, you know, so Matt Preston's going to be the inspector. So Amanda's typing at that little cafe near the Yarra. I've forgotten the name of it now.
Canteen.
And she's typing away and she hears a voice that's very similar to the voice that's in her head. She turns out you're sitting next to her. So how, yeah. I mean, what a, you know, you definitely send out the vibe. I think there's something special about you that you're always your tentacles are everywhere.
I think, you know, I mean, I worked with Rhonda who wrote The Secret, which was all about coincidence. And we never talked about that. We never talked about that when I was working for her, but you kind of go, How many times does that happen? How many times for the number of times it happens, how many times do you not register how close you are to that thing happening? You know, that you bump into someone in Disneyland and you go, what's the thought of a spoke? But how many times did you almost bump into those people? That starts to bamboozle me that maybe the world makes you feel that the world is actually a much smaller place than this giant ball of gas with all these million people on.
Yeah. Question six is, when was the last time you cried and why?
I thought about that, and then about an hour and a half ago, being interviewed by Virginia Trioli, and she asked me about what made me sad, most recently what made me sad, and I started talking about, I think during lockdown everyone was a bit wound, but I got really upset with the death of Michael Gudinski. I spontaneously cried a couple of times over Michael's passing. And I mean, look, I love Michael. He's great fun. And I'd go for lunch with him occasionally, but he wasn't like a best mate. He was very close to a friend of mine who couldn't obviously get back from the funeral. So I think that's part of it. So I had a bit of a tear then. And then I suppose that was also combined by thinking about my mother, who was diagnosed with myeloma about a year ago. And obviously going through that idea, you've got an 88-year-old relative on the other side of the world you can't get to see, that's been a pretty horrible situation. So those combinations, I think, probably the last time that I cried. But I'll cry at anything. If you'd asked me that question, yesterday at this time, I probably would have said watching Ted Lasso.
I've cried. I've cried a lot during Lasso. What's your current state of mind?
This is what's great about going through these questions in advance and thinking about them. At the time you sent them to me, maybe a week ago, it was kind of heightened mania, you know, that kind of, oh my God, we're out and about. What am I going to do? Where am I going to go? And the book's coming out. I've got this publicity to do. And the borders are open. I can now go and see my mum. And that means I need to get a ticket, and I need to work out what the vaccination thing. So there's all that stuff going on. So it was really pretty scatty at that point. A week later, I'm just happy. I'm happy we're out. I've had a lovely weird thing of doing publicity, because I've been doing this job for 14 years now. So many people, that's how I met you. I would never have met you if I hadn't done this job. I just got off the phone with the guys who do, Nathan, Nat and Sean, who are beautiful human beings. Whenever I go to Perth, I try and catch up with them for a meal, because they're just lovely people. So that kind of ability to actually catch up and see in a very short period of time people you know and love and like has been amazing. That's an amazing thing to do. You know, I'm at the end of this, I've found mates picking me up after the end, we're going to Campari House for drinks for a friend's birthday. How amazing is that? After 250 days of lockdown. I think I've gone from manicness into a kind of thankful, beatific state.
That's lovely. What do you consider your greatest achievement?
Again, still being married. Would be one, and that, but that's probably my wife's achievement rather than mine.
Yeah, but you'll take it.
But I'll take it. You know, having three healthy, happy, entertaining, excellent children. But again, that's their achievement rather than mine. It's going to take me back. I'd suggest I'm pretty proud of the Spanakopita Jaffel. I'm pretty proud of some of those instant mayonnaises. And I'm pretty I'm pretty happy that I was able to discover a recipe for spaghetti bolognese that comes out that places that's 4 years older than anything else anyone else has found before. Because spaghetti bolognese is such a central dish, and to find anything new about that, that's kind of, I've done my job.
What's new? It's a spoiler?
It's because the first recipe is in an Adelaide newspaper. The first recipe was supposed to be Elizabeth David, greatest English cook, 1950, mid-50s. And I've managed to find, I'm there doing my research, going through spaghetti bolognese, reading every relevant comment on spaghetti bolognese and trying to find a recipe. And the first one I can find in all the UK papers and all the American papers, all the Australian papers, is in Adelaide, 1950. The Mail, here it goes. You know, tomatoes, mint, spaghetti. That's like,
unbelievable.
And then the same thing with pavlova. So that. I mean, yeah. I hope. I'm also mindful that these will be greatest achievements for right now, because I being able to prove that Australia's probably got a bigger claim to pavlova than New Zealand, and refute that old kind of chestnut, which we kind of rolled over in the past. Be able to actually say no, it's ours and maybe the Germans, but it's ours and someone else. I don't mind sharing. Don't mind sharing the kudos with the Prussians or the Texans maybe, but sharing it with the New Zealanders, that was too much for many people. But I'm also mindful that, you know, that in 2 years' time, 6 months' time, 5 years' time, another menu might appear from somewhere else, or you know, something from Pavlova's tour in 26, a menu will come up, or that the whole point about the truth, and that's why in the book I always talk about, you know, it's the myth and it's my truth, is because we know that these things change, and the stuff that we take as being, you know, truth is not a stationary concept in terms of things like that, where we can only say what's truthful based on what we can see and know, and there's always more stuff to be discovered, and that's kind of exciting. It's living.
That's where your history knowledge comes into play. I saw you on ADBC and you just were ridiculously good. I think that, you know, you've seen the arc of history on many subjects, and food operates in a similar way.
But I think you're absolutely right. And I think you look in, and it matters in the same way. It's got consequences. I like the fact of all those unsung heroes, that it's great to be able to celebrate guys like McPherson Robertson, you know, the guy who invented the cherry ripe, and the Freddo Frog and the Columbine, who also supported the confectioners, the formation of the Confectioners Union, also supported the push for the 8-hour working day. I mean, he's a mate, you know, we see him, his name's there on a bridge, it's on a school. We kind of don't know more about that. So it's lovely to be able to find some of those people and celebrate those. Therese Bellissimo, who invented the buffalo wing, you know, this is good.
And it's as
Brillat Savarin famously said, the invention of a new dish does more for the happiness of mankind than the discovery of a new star. And it's that idea. Wow. So we should be going, you know, that every time you have a buffalo wing, you go, Therese, I think you're actually, that's delicious. So I think that stuff is kind of groovy and exciting.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. Second last question, who would you want on your side in a battle and why?
Oh, well, there are two answers there. On one, it's Gary.
Gary is, of course, Matt's MasterChef co-judge, Gary Meagan.
He's fiercely loyal and he's also a bit scary.
Yeah, is he?
He's a bit scary.
Because he comes across as so benign
Put a pair of boxing gloves on him, he's not so benign.
Wow.
And the other one is I would quite like a really aggressive and very loyal Bengal tiger flying a Lockheed Martin F-45 fighter jet. Because like I'm kind of well suited. If the tiger has to bail out and come down in the parachute, he's going to be able to do most stuff on the ground. And the fighter jet, you know, that's advanced technology, and we can deal with everything else. So I reckon I ring most battles. I think Gary is probably more scary.
But I love the thought that's gone into the tiger and the jet. That's brilliant.
It's got to be a loyal tiger. It's got to be like Shiva from The Walking Dead.
Yeah, yeah.
I used to be
mates with the showrunner of season 2 and 3, Glenn Mazzara.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. You're like, I'm going to hang out with you more and just sit at your feet and listen to stories.
Glenn Mazzara, who showran The Walking Dead and The Shield, is the only super successful showrunner I know, and I enjoy dropping his name whenever possible. Moving on to the final question, what would Matt like his last words to be?
Oh, that was delicious.
Yeah, perfect.
Actually, no, I think, I know, actually, wait a second. That was delicious. I love you.
Ah.
There you are. I think that's probably the better one.
Thank you so much for tuning into 10 Questions. We'd also like to thank all the guests that appear on the show. And if you have a minute, please subscribe via iTunes or your podcast app and leave us a rating. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach me on Twitter @AdamZwar. So until next time, thanks for joining us.